Hi, welcome to In the Know with Dr. O. We're recording in the Esports Innovation Lab within the University of Cincinnati 1819 Innovation Hub. I'm David O, Chief Medical Officer of Hawksworth Blood Center. Hawksworth is the blood and blood services provider for all hospitals in Cincinnati and the surrounding tri-state area. We're really pleased today to be joined by Cole Williams. Cole is a graduate of the University of Cincinnati, where he studied nursing and political science. He is a registered nurse in Boston, Massachusetts, and he's the founder of Pride in Plasma, an organization that fights for equality in blood, tissue, and organ donation. Founded in 2022 to advocate for a revision to the FDA's three-month blanket deferral for blood donation from queer men, Pride in Plasma has expanded its work to include the FDA's five-year deferral for tissue donation from queer men, equitable treatment for gender-diverse blood and tissue donors, and organ donation regulation. Cole, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So we usually start out and because you are kind of a superhero in terms of trying to increase blood donation and the people who can donate blood, we like to hear your origin story. So tell us a little bit about where you were born and a little bit about your parents, if you can.
Yeah, so I am from Aurora, Illinois. And for those of you who are not from the Midwest, that is about 30 miles west of Chicago. In high school, I donated blood at blood drives that were at school. And then I found out about the deferment criteria. That was before 2020 when it was a 12-month blanket deferment.
So let's talk a little bit about kind of your experience with that blood drive. So did you know anything about blood donation, blood transfusion before the blood drive happened?
Honestly, not really. This was back when I was like 16. So I knew that I was interested in nursing, but they said,
"Hey, you're interested in healthcare, right?" And so then probably the blood donation there was a little bit of, "Hey, this is a health related thing. You should go do. It's a good thing to do." So you signed up, and then you were going to donate. And was it the questions then that kind of rose the awareness for you, or what?
I was able to donate in high school, and then I found out about the policy, and I wasn't the biggest fan then, but I wasn't really impacted by it. After I went to college, that's right when COVID hit in 2020, after my freshman year, and there were just so many commercials on the TV. I feel like you couldn't go to a commercial break without seeing them from the Red Cross saying, "Hey, we're in a national blood shortage. Make your appointment today."
So first it was just, I can't donate. And at that time it was a 12-month deferral, or it was a three-month deferral by then?
So I think the 3-month came out in like March. So it was right around that time, but it wouldn't have been implemented that fast. So it still probably would have been 12 months. And I didn't think anything about it. I wasn't in love with the policy, but I didn't think, okay, well, let's try to change it.
So let's go back a little bit, and we can talk a little bit about the history of this thing, right? So in the early 70s, in the 70s, there was no questions like related to this. They did some testing for blood, and really it was for hepatitis B, and it was for syphilis testing. And that was really, in terms of infectious diseases, what they tested for back then. In the late 70s, early 80s, right, HIV hit the United States. And we didn't even identify it really in the first years of 1980 in terms of what this was until HIV was identified a little bit later on. The first test for HIV in terms of donor screening happened in 1985. It was an antibody test. It was just a fantastic test. And about this time, FDA, I think a little bit before the antibody test came out, they came out with a policy where they started asking men about MSM, or men who have had sex with men. So they would ask men, "Hey, are you a male who's had sex with another male even once since 1977? And that was the initial policy, right? And it made sense in 1983, right, when 1977 was 6 years ago, and there was no test for HIV, right? So they were really trying to catch folks that would have increased risk. And in some parts of the country, at that time period, risk of transfusion transmitted HIV was as high as 1 in 100 transfusions. And that was kind of in the San Francisco area before testing kind of came out. As soon as testing came out, it became much better, but there still were concerns. And the test came out in 1985. It's an antibody-based test. There's what we call a window period. There are a couple issues with the testing. There's a window period, which initially I think we weren't really sure exactly what the window period was, but 6 months is kind of what we went with. We knew that was conservative. And FDA was kind of like, yeah. And so since we're not sure exactly, we don't want any people infected with HIV to be donating blood and having it transmitted, we're going to ask, hey, have you had, are a man who's had sex with another man since 1977? And that policy persisted then from 1985, when the test was developed, all the way through 2015. And it's a little draconian, right? When you're in 2010 and you've got such improvements in the testing, long history of trust in the testing, additional testing now, which is the nucleic acid testing introduced around 2000, which decreased the transfusion transmission theoretical risk to about 1 in 2 million. Really, really low. And then practically, what I can tell you is since the implementation of NAT testing in 2000, there have probably been less than 5 cases of transfusion-transmitted HIV documented. So, and there are about 17 million transfusions occurring every year. So really, 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 really low risk. And we're still asking, hey, have you had sex with another man since 1977, right? That was just not right. They made changes in 2015 to make it more consistent with other activities that were considered higher risk for HIV and hepatitis. And they changed it to 12 months. And I thought that that was a great step forward, because at that time, we were still deferring folks, if you had a tattoo in a state that wasn't regulated, 12 months. If you had a blood transfusion, 12 months, even though we're doing all this testing and the rate is 1 in 2 million, we were still deferring people for 12. It was kind of 12 months was kind of the standard. I think FDA knew that that was very conservative. COVID hit, and then 2020 March, FDA came out with new policies to say, okay, we're going to have trouble getting people to donate blood. We're going to make that 12-month deferral a 3-month deferral. And that was much more in line with kind of where I think a lot of people felt comfortable. But many gay advocates and gay advocacy groups still felt that that was not enough. And so that's kind of the point where, sorry for talking so much, but that's kind of the point where I think you were starting to think about blood donation and thinking, oh my gosh, it's still a 3-month deferral for active gay men. And essentially, you know, there aren't that many other federal regulations. I think there are 0 federal regulations which treated people differently based on sexual activity. And so my understanding is that this is the big thing, that it was regulatory policy based on your sexual activity and identity.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that it was a very big change when we look at lifetime deferral to 12 months. The FDA didn't have a ton of data, but once we look at the 12 months to 3 months, they could review the numbers and see if there was any increase in risk of transmission or any numbers of increase in transmission. And when there weren't, that allows us to push those deferral criteria just a little bit further. So that was one of the reasons that Pride and Plasma wanted to go in a research advocacy route over, you know, like a lawsuit, one, because right, we didn't have money. But that we could get all the way to whatever the highest court they would hear us out at. And they could say, you know, maybe there is discrimination here, but maybe there's a scientific justification and we make legal decisions, not scientific ones. So that's why we really wanted to say, you know, is this something that is discriminatory? Is there a risk with a change in policy? And if there is, then honestly, we shouldn't be advocating against it, because although HIV is treatable today and it is preventative through different measures, we're not advocating for giving people HIV, which is a good thing, because not all men who have sex with men or transgender women and non-binary individuals who are assigned male at birth, who these policies were frequently applied to, have HIV, which is really where we get into the stigma.
Yeah. I think that's a big part of the concern about the questions the way they were asked in 2000, you know, before this most recent change we'll talk about in a little bit, is because it kind of made you almost assume that those certain folks had HIV, right? It didn't, but that was kind of the impression that I think left a lot of people with, you know, in terms of some of those questions. So I think due to similar groups to yours, there's a real push to try to get more scientific information, right, related to, gosh, is this still something that happens, especially with the testing that we have? And we could look at other countries' experiences in terms of different ways of doing qualification. So England, Canada, they were real kind of leaders in this to say, you know, we're not going to ask this MSM questions anymore. We're going to ask based on individual risk factors. And so they started asking, instead of, are you a man who's had sex with man and categorized in that way, they did a study and they looked at, hey, if you have had, what are the big risk factors that would increase the likelihood you have HIV? And then that are based on individual risk, and let's ask those questions instead of these other questions. And so the two questions that they came up with that I think were valid and that we continue to ask now with the change is, have you had a new sexual partner in the last 3 months? And have you had multiple sexual partners in the last 2 months? And whether you're a man or a woman, like, those are kind of, yeah, oh gosh, you've got a new partner or you've had multiple, there's an increased risk for you to have been exposed to HIV. And then they go the next step. If you answer either of those questions yes, then have you had anal sex in the last 3 months? And that route of sexual activity is associated with a much higher rate of HIV transmission. So they're looking at, number one, is it possible your partner or your source of exposure has HIV? And then have you engaged in activity that is at higher risk for transmission? And then if both those questions are asked, we ask, hey, wait 3 months before you come and donate. But it allows active gay men, especially if they're in monogamous relationships and long-term relationships, to actually be able to come out and donate. And so that's kind of knowing from blood bank professionals, the mindset that kind of we came in with. And I think it was in line with kind of your thought process and other advocates for gay rights.
Yeah, that's very similar to our own thoughts. So previously, when we're in a national shortage, we don't really have the wiggle room to turn away healthy donors. And that's what the previous policy was doing. It was treating everybody who had, you know, men who had sex with men, sexual activity the same, which it's not. You touched upon different routes of sexual activity have varying risks of all different sexually transmitted transmission, not just HIV, which is the one that we're talking about right now. So when you look at individuals who are having oral sex, you know, they're at a lower risk, so they shouldn't be screened as the same risk level when looking at blood donation, which I think is important. And in the 2020 policy that cut it down to 3 months of a blanket deferral, we had one line from the FDA that said, for the purpose of the screening history questionnaire, male or female gender should be both self-identified and self-reported. Yeah. Well, you know, that's a little bit better than not having any recommendation. But, you know, it is a little exclusionary having male or female gender because there are other genders out there. And then in the 2023 update, they removed that along when they removed all gendered language, which is a big step forward. But then there's no federal recommendation on how blood banks should screen gender diverse donors. If somebody has transitioned to a different gender and gone under surgery and is on hormones, you know, when we're looking at their finger stick, well, which scale do we look at? Which weight do we look at? And all these other vital signs that the FDA has not said how we treat blood donors. And a donor's experience can be vastly different from blood bank to blood bank.
So I'm glad you talked about the gender identification as well. It's an issue that is really, to me, a little surprising how there are certain people who get very, very sensitive about the issue just to say, oh my gosh, you're asking for another category. Like, you asked for men, you asked for women, that should be enough, right? And just last week I got a note from somebody kind of taking that stance. And so what we have done, because when you really look at gender identification, there's so many now new categories, right? And for our purposes, we want to know if you're male because there are certain hemoglobin levels that we have for that. There's certain, when you donate, there's certain programs that we do based on gender, because your body composition is different and the amount of body fluid that you have is different. And so when we collect platelets, especially using our devices, we need to know if we enter into the machine if you're male or female based on, you know, physiologic things. And then we have a category we created as other. And I don't know if that's the right term to use, but we wanted to have men, women, and then all other categories. And those people who identify as non-traditional binary, then we take the most conservative settings. So when we have people donate blood, if you're a male, you can donate with a hemoglobin of 13. If you're female, it's 12.5. We say, okay, you can only donate if you have hemoglobin of 13, if you identify as non-male or non-female, so we're as safe as possible. For the devices, you know, it's set to whatever is assuming the lowest blood volume. And so we kind of use that for those purposes. And then essentially, that's why we're asking that question. So I get that a lot in terms of why are you even asking this stuff? And that's kind of why there are certain settings that we have in terms of blood collection that are determined by the self-identified gender.
Sounds great.
So FDA came out, we've alluded to this already, March 2023, and they came out with a whole new guidance, and they said, hey, we're going to use this advanced study data that we showed that there's no increased risk if we go to the non-MSM questions and we use individual risk assessment. And so all the blood centers have been implementing that over the rest of the year 2023. And we were able to implement in early December here at Hawksworth Blood Center. And so I think almost all blood centers now are using this new universal donor history questionnaire. They didn't necessarily have to, but practically kind of we've all moved to that. And fortunately, it's been very, very well accepted in the public. I have to say there are actually some gay advocacy groups that are still not satisfied with where we've gone. And so let's talk a little bit about that.
Oh, yes. I have a lot to say about this. we have received plenty of, I don't know if backlash is the best term, from both sides of the aisle with this updated policy. And that's another part, is just because the FDA released their draft guidance in January, it still has to go through a public comment period. And we didn't actually see the final guidance released until, I want to say, May of 2023. Yeah. Yep. And then from there, it has to go to the Association for Advancement of Blood and Biotherapies, AABB, for a new screening questionnaire. They had that released on the same day. But for a lot of people at home, they're like, why did it take until December? You know, why isn't it, okay, here's the new policy, boom, let's type a new question into the questionnaire on like Google Docs. And unfortunately, the systems for a lot of blood centers, it's a lot more complex than that. So I definitely see it as a win. And from our own tracking, I agree. It looks like just about everybody has put this in place. And like you said, also, the FDA sets the bare minimum. So if somebody wants some more strict criteria in terms of who can donate at their blood centers, they are more than welcome to do that. My hometown blood center, back from 2020 to 2023, it wasn't actually a 3-month deferral for men who have sex with men. It was actually 4 months. So if I went to the Red Cross, I might have been able to donate on one day. But if I went to a different one, I might not have been able to. Specifically with some advocacy organizations, I think that a lot of the conversation right now is around PrEP, and a lot of it is just due to people understanding the effect of PrEP medications and maybe not the mechanism of action, which is something that Pride and Plasma really works on. We want to make these issues accessible for people that don't have a healthcare background or don't have a policy background. So PrEP medications are, PrEP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis, and there's also PEP, which is post-exposure prophylaxis. They work in similar ways. So they prevent your body from seroconverting or having an HIV infection from replicating within your own body. So this is a pill for PrEP that you take every single day, or sometimes they have injections, which you might do once a month. And it is for individuals who are identified to maybe be at a little bit higher risk of HIV infection. So frequently we see this within the LGBTQ+ community, with transgender women and men who have sex with men. who are taking these medications to make sure that they don't end up getting HIV. And then you have to be tested every 3 months. So you'll see somebody say, okay, undetectable is untransmittable. If you are tested every 3 months and you are testing negative for HIV, you cannot transmit it through sexual activity. PrEP medications are amazing. We need more people to have access to them, to be able to afford prescriptions for them. They are life-saving medications, and they are critical to fighting the HIV epidemic. U equals U, undetectable is untransmittable, only applies to sexual activity. Awesome. The amount of fluid that is transmitted between two individuals, between a blood transfusion and sexual activity, is vastly different. There's a lot more transmitted through a blood transfusion. And these medications don't prevent HIV from entering your body. They prevent it from replicating. Yep. We talked about testing methods earlier on in the show. The current testing methods are leaps and bounds better than they were back in the 1980s and 90s. They're not perfect. There is still a threshold from where you could have a small amount of a virus or any type of infection within your body. And it wouldn't be detectable, but it would still be there. So that's where the risk is, that you could have a non-zero but undetectable amount of HIV within your blood that for you, because you were on this prescription regimen that you take every single day, you will not progress to an HIV infection, which is great for you. The person who is receiving your blood transfusion might not be taking that same medication. And if they had received even just a small, 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 minuscule amount of HIV within that transfusion, they could progress to an HIV infection. Currently you're taking oral medications for a 3 month deferral from the last time you took it. This is directly in line with treatments for other sexually transmitted infections. If you have gone under treatment via medication for sexually transmitted infections within the past 3 months, you are not eligible to donate at this time. It's the exact same reason, not because it's not because you got an ST. It's because the medication interfere with the testing mechanism's ability to detect the infectious agent within your body.
Wow, that's exactly what I was going to say. I've said that so many times. I thought that you were going to come and say, yeah, there's a problem because folks on PrEP are not allowed to donate. But that's exactly the rationale for, unfortunately, folks who are on PrEP are not eligible to donate. And if you come in to donate, you'll be asked that question. And PrEP, you know, is you've had an exposure then that you know, and so that is the same thing. The medications can blunt the body's response, actually, in terms of antibody formation as well. And so that's, we have two tiers of testing, one antibodies and one directly looking for the virus. And so both of those get a little blunted with folks who are on PrEP. I don't anticipate actually seeing, you know, cases of this happening, because I think that folks are conscientious, and if they're on PrEP, they're donate. But it is something now that we do ask about, and it's not meant to be discriminatory. It is kind of based on the testing methodologies that we use. And so thank you so much for clearing that up. So let me ask you, how did you go to the mechanics of actually forming your organization, Pride and Plasma? That must have been not easy, right? I mean, so what did you do? I want to do this. You just set up a shingle and you.
Yeah. So I will tell you the story. This is treasonous to say, because there's no nurses on it whatsoever. I am a big fan of Grey's Anatomy. I watch it every single week. And on whatever season they were on back in 2022, their season finale, there was a blood shortage. I was like, oh my gosh, that's great. And one of the gay doctors, Dr. Schmidt, wasn't able to donate because of the FDA's deferment criteria. And Dr. Bailey said to Schmidt, I will help you fight this like hateful, unjust rule. And I said, no, she won't. Nothing's going to happen. Great that they're providing coverage, but nothing is going to come from this. You know, no policy change is going to come from an hour of coverage on Grey's Anatomy. Funny. So I said, you know, I don't like it. I feel like I am in a unique position being a nursing and political science student, because I was still in college at that time. Why don't I try something? So I started to look into it, looking at the history. I got in contact with some members of the National Gay Blood Drive who helped cut it down to a 12-month policy back in 2015. They were massive grassroots mobilization. And then we started to do research. I talked about earlier, I didn't think that this is discriminatory, this is like differential treatments. It was, but I didn't think that that was necessarily the best route to take, because I thought that they would say, maybe it is, but that's a scientific issue. There could be some kind of justification there. So we looked at the research. I got my other intern. I was interning in Congress with Representative Lauren Underwood at that time, only one of three nurses in Congress right now, and from the town next over. So she was in that office and one of the other interns, and I started talking to them about this policy and said, hey, you got some free time? And then I roped in my best friend and that other intern. They knew somebody as well who was actually doing research on it at an undergrad level and was about to publish their research paper. And that was the four of us. After that, we started working on social media, getting people aware of the issue. And we started looking at the literature, is there any numbers on who this is impacting? And then we really broke it down to the smallest issues. One, because we wanted to make sure that we hit every topic. Two, because we wanted to make this issue completely accessible for people without a healthcare or policy background. And then three, because we wanted a really strong argument for the FDA. So we looked at, different testing mechanisms and when have those changed? What were the testing mechanisms that were available in 85 when this policy started versus 2015 versus now? We looked at shortages and we reached out to blood centers across the country for testimony because we hear, we're in a blood shortage. But what does that actually mean for patients, providers, and facilities in your community? Like if somebody has to cancel 5 elective surgeries a week, that's 5 patients, that's 20 providers, all these different people that are being impacted by policies. We looked at global policies and what other countries were doing, kind of saying, hey, FDA, look at your neighbors, look at the other kids in the class. And we put that all together into our brief and we submitted it to the FDA. And I spoke in front of their Blood Products Advisory Committee on December 5th of 2022. About, however many months from May when we started. And then we saw an updated draft guidance released in January. We worked with the advanced study, which you mentioned earlier as well, who was doing research on this. And we wanted to say to the FDA, patients, providers, facilities in your communities are hurting. There are healthy eligible or healthy ineligible donors who could be helping alleviate shortages. It's not going to fix the national blood shortage, but it could do something to help. You have the power to do something. Why aren't you? And then here we are today.
I appreciate your advocacy and your interest and your motivation and energy, I guess, is what I'm looking for to make change in the world that you believe in. We always ask a question of our guests who are on, and I'll change it up a little bit for you. So because of the advocacy in terms of gay men to donate. If you could talk to an individual who has not donated ever and is thinking about donating, especially if they're LGBTQ, what would you say to them in terms of the importance of donating blood?
I will probably give it a little bit of a different perspective because I give blood not every single shift, but as a nurse working bedside, there's no substitute. I have patients who wouldn't still be alive if we didn't have the thankless gift of blood donation. They do give you a gift card or some cookies and some t-shirt, but really the benefit of blood donation is that you are saving lives. There's no other way to put it. You are keeping people alive. You are allowing healthcare workers to provide these treatments to patients. And unfortunately, we are always in a shortage. You can't have too many blood donations because on the other end of the spectrum, if you don't have enough, people can die. So if you are eligible now, I really urge you to donate. If you feel a little bit upset or still frustrated at the FDA over 30 plus years of ineligibility, the FDA is not hurting by your kind of like boycott of donations. Right. We saw that all the time where, oh, until this policy is done, I'm not going to donate on like in solidarity. The FDA is completely untouched by that. It is blood banks, it is facilities, patients and providers in your community that are hurting because of the current shortage. And it keeps on getting worse. Younger donors are not currently donating at the same rates that older individuals were. And as those donors leave the eligible pool, we are seeing really, really bad shortages across the country. Weather delays, blood drive cancellations. Blood donation is free and you get some snacks. So I think it would be great. And I also just want to shout out the University Blood Initiative is a fantastic organization that we have partnered with multiple times. They are really working on getting out younger, frequent repeat donors because that's something that we desperately need in the industry.
Yeah. When I was at Stanford, I know one of the universities, San Jose, was an early advocate for, outspoken critic of the MSM policies, and they actually banned blood collection, you know, on their campus. And I totally understood where they were coming from, but gosh, who do you hurt? You don't hurt FDA. They didn't care. It was, somehow you were able to focus your actions to be productive with that regulatory agency. And they have responded, I have to say. It took 30 years, but sometimes the leadership changes and sometimes, there are other things that happen, but that change did come. And so I'm really pleased that that happened. So, well, Cole, it's been fabulous talking to you today.
Could I just do like two tiny points?
I think you can, sure.
Okay. Just in terms of next steps. So in September of this year, the United Kingdom, who implemented the same eligibility criteria for the individual risk assessment just about a year before the United States did, they released their numbers off of that first year, and there was no change in infection risk. Obviously, we can't use United Kingdom data for United States policies, but it is a good indicator. So when we see that under this current policy, there's not an increase in risk, I don't think that, multiple donors and anal sex or multiple sexual partners and anal sexual activity or new partners and anal sexual activity necessarily is our finish line. We are going to always be needing to increase the number of eligible safe donors and pushing these eligibility criteria just a little bit further when it's safe to do so, when the data indicates that that's an okay thing to do or a good thing to do. I think that in the future, we will have more people who are able to donate when we expand these eligibility criteria. So maybe we follow organ donation and we have a 30-day policy instead of 3 months, or maybe we push it to two partners in the past month or in 2 months, something like that. And then also, just with tissue donation, the FDA still has a 5-year deferral for men who have sex with men. Tissues include everything from cornea and sclera in your eye to your skin, your blood vessels, cartilage, ligaments, tendons, bones, a whole bunch of different things. And the FDA has actually not touched that policy since it was started in 1994. It is still a 5-year deferral. It was never lifetime like it was with blood. But the eligibility criteria as a whole hasn't been changed since 2007. So that's one that we really are pushing for right now with Pride and Plasma. With blood donation, you could go to a blood bank and you could be told, okay, you're ineligible because of XYZ, come back on this date and you will be able to give. With tissue donation, almost all the donors are deceased at the time of screening. So yeah. People who are subject to this policy and who the policy are being applied to, they aren't aware of it and they can't speak up for themselves. So that's something that Pride and Plasma really finds important. And that's what our big project right now is.
Great. Well, I'll follow your progress on that as you go through. So thank you again for taking time to speak with us today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
So you've been listening to In the Know with Dr. O. Thank you very much.